Let us start. Thanks to all for coming for this Hellenic Observatory seminar. It's a pleasure to be welcoming today Philip Katsinas. Philip is a Hellenic Bank Association postdoctoral research fellow here at the Hellenic Observatory. He has a PhD from the Department of Geography at King's College, London, and he previously obtained, if I find it, an MA degree in World Cities and Urban Life at the Department of Sociology in Goldsmiths, and a BA in Sociology at the University of Vienna. His field is broadly at the intersection of sociology and urban geography. Philip has presented his work in a number of big conferences in the field of geography, including the Association of American Association of Geographers and the Royal Geographic Society here in the UK. He's a member of the editorial board of City, a journal on urban geography, and he has published already in Area, a well-known geography journal. And I also, looking at his CV, he has edited a book on dialectics of liberation.
In German, though.
Yeah. Google Translate said it was the dialectics of liberation. So, Philip has also built already some teaching experience. He has taught at the University of Sussex, Berber College, and King's College, where he did his PhD. As I said, his research is relating to sociology and urban geography, and today he's going to be talking about transforming the housing system, austerity, and property taxation during the Greek crisis.
Well, thank you for the introduction, Vasily. It's really a pleasure to be here tonight. Thank you, everybody, for coming. What I'm going to be presenting is part of an ongoing project. It's ongoing work, as Vasily said, on the impact of post-crisis regulatory interventions by the Greek state and by supranational institutions in Greece, and the impact of the strategies by banks and transnational investors on the housing system in Greece. This research project has so far been based on the analysis of data sources such as financial and real estate press, international and national, mostly national real estate press in Greece, reports by real estate investment companies, to which I'm going to be coming back, and moreover, I have conducted a series of expert interviews with various stakeholders, including local and state government officials, representatives of real estate investment companies, and with real estate agents working for major real estate companies. So I'm going to start by saying a few things about the concept of financialization and about the process of financialization, and then I will refer to the specificities of the Greek housing system. Following this, I will briefly discuss the roots of the housing crisis in Greece and how this differs from the housing crisis that we saw in the US or in Spain, for instance, which in the Greek case would be the result of austerity measures and of increased taxation, and then refer to legal interventions implemented by the Greek state to deal with the situation of increasing private indebtedness. Then I'll analyze the regulatory changes that have allowed the entry of transnational investors into the Greek real estate market, and what such investors have been doing so far with reference both to commercial real estate and the housing market, so residential real estate. I will finish by discussing the impact of the interventions by state and private actors in housing and the features of the housing system, the Greek housing system, more generally. So, what do we talk about when we refer to financialization? Obviously, the term refers to finance, and the -ization part suggests that it is not an end result, but rather it's a process, it's an action, something that is being made. So generally, when we talk about finance, we refer to the management of funds. This might include money, this might include investments, shares. So funds which might be owned outright, or funds that might be raised through shares, for example, or borrowed, like loans, for personal, corporate, or public goals. Financialization, then, in its most basic terms, is then the process by which something or someone is managed as a fund. A working definition, then, could thus be, following Manuel Albers, that financialization is the increasing dominance of financial actors, markets, practices, measurements, and narratives at various scales, resulting in a structural transformation of economies, firms, states, and households. So this notion is then referring to the growing importance that finance has gained in contemporary societies, especially regarding economic and political governance. Looking specifically at housing, financialization is often perceived as the tendency to treat housing as a pure financial asset rather than a home for people. So housing is thus seen as a commodity, an exchange value, rather than a use value. It's seen as a means of accumulating wealth or a security for financial instruments that are traded and sold on the market. If we look specifically at urban development, say that urban development requires a functioning credit system which would allocate interest-bearing capital to real estate in order to secure returns. The urban landscape, therefore, has increasingly become an attractive option for finance capital that has accumulated globally in recent decades. Debt is then the principal mechanism of financialization, and this is reflected in the form of specific contracts, such as mortgages or other types of loans and bonds, or by the proliferation of financial tools like securities and derivatives. This is the standard case if looking at the US crisis. So before the 2007-2008 crisis in the US, the expansion of credit intensified capital circulation through personal debt. Households increasingly relied on credit for access to home ownership, as states also promoted mortgage home ownership to keep financial markets and the aggregate economy growing. This was also supported by policies of securitization under the assumption that splitting commodities into securities will enhance the exchange value of mortgages and will provide more liquidity to banks. So loans issued by banks were repackaged into financial products for which banks could then charge fees. Once the loans were repackaged and sold, the money was again reinvested in other financial products. As a result, real estate, despite being spatially fixed in a specific location, so despite being an immobile asset, indivisible normally, illiquid, with a long-term investment horizon, and also directly dependent on national or local regulatory interventions, was increasingly transformed into a tradable financial asset, such as shares, bonds, or securities. But this growth cycle came to a halt in 2008 due to the crisis. And in the crisis aftermath, novel policy has been advanced to address housing. So in the case of mortgage and housing crisis in countries like the US and Spain, the housing sector has been largely restructured in the post-crisis years, promoting further rounds of financialization, with mortgaged defaulting properties being sold to international investors, both for strategies of buy low and sell high, what we could call financialization one, but also for a process called financialization two, in which these companies make a stable profit out of rental income streams, or are even able to repackage rental contracts into securities, so-called rental-backed securities. As I already said, my research project is focused on housing in Greece and how and if the Greek housing system is impacted by these latest rounds of financialization in the post-crisis years. So as you probably already know, important differences exist in housing and access to housing between Greece and its Western European counterparts. And this was especially the case until the 1990s. So first of all, the Greek housing system is characterized by a large rate of home ownership and owner occupation, which at the moment is still close to 75%. It is also characterized by the absence of public housing, and this absence and the weakness of welfare institutions and of formal legal controls over land use has fostered a highly individualized and unplanned pattern of urban development in the post-war period, rapidly transforming the major cities and producing mixed land uses. Another important feature of the Greek housing system is the relationship between access to housing and family structures, so-called familialism, or the familialistic welfare system, also found in other Southern European countries. In the case of Greece, the extended family acted as the main social institution contributed to housing provision for its members, employing a variety of practices. It would employ self-provision, intergenerational sharing, or families would assist youth with purchases, and would also contribute to the management of inherited property. Finally, the strategies of self-promotion and self-provision played an important role in housing supply. On the one hand, this included the construction of unlicensed buildings on the periphery of major cities, in areas lacking basic infrastructure and amenities, so areas outside of the city plans. Such constructions and the informal settlements in which they were constructed were later legalized and incorporated into city plans. The other major strategy developed at the same time was the antiparochy system, which included the construction of high-rise housing blocks, or polykatikias in Greek, like the ones on this image. This image, by the way, is from Athens. And this construction process led to the homogenization of the urban landscape with relatively cheap constructions of these blocks of flats of a rather low aesthetic value. So antiparochy, in general, is an informal and not taxable agreement between the owner of a land plot or of a construction and a developer or builder without any direct state involvement in the process. So what happened through the antiparochy process was that the landowner passed the plot to a developer, to a construction firm usually of small scale though, in return for a part of the final built construction. So the final constructions consisted of several story apartment blocks, like these ones, but also would be able in some cases to accommodate offices or businesses on the ground floors. So as I said, the owner of the plot was granted some of the apartments, depending on the total value of the built construction and the land price, while the construction could sell the remaining properties. And the extra apartments that the landowner acquired could then either be rented out or they could be given to family members. So again, this familialism of the Greek housing system. So as a result, this process of antiparochy contributed to changes in economic and social status and in social relations in Greece, as broad social strata, which owned a small land plot, were able to become lower middle class homeowners and landlords. And these two systems of housing provision, so the antiparochy system and the system of illegal building at the fringes of the cities, functions as a capital accumulation model that attracted investments and provided high profits to the small contractors, to land owners, and to an expanding market for the building material industry up to the 1990s. So the result of these strategies was widespread owner occupation, which absorbed all of the social classes. So high rates of owner occupation are to be found in all social classes in Greece, and thus produced individualized subjects which were vulnerable to co-optation, usually by clientelistic networks, in the Greek case, and did not foster the development of housing movements or any demands for public housing, as access to housing was cheap and available to almost everyone. Then another important feature of the Greek housing system is the high rate of unoccupied dwellings and also the very high importance of secondary home ownership. Now, when looking at this map, we can see that the rate of unoccupied dwellings is quite high in the European South, so in Greece, Cyprus, the south of Italy, Spain and Portugal. And it's significantly higher than in the rest of the continent. Nevertheless, within Greece, the areas of Athens, of Attica here, and of Thessaloniki in the north have lower vacancy rates than the rest of the country.
So this includes second homes, holiday homes?
Yes, this
counts as unoccupied.
This includes any type of unoccupied home, no matter if you're using it for a month, per year, seasonally or not. By the way, these are data from 2011, so census data from the national censuses from 2011 and organized by regional unit, on a regional unit level within the European Union. So this high rate, this high vacancy rate of properties is important in two ways. On the one hand, it is relevant to property foreclosures and to the personal bankruptcy law, to which I will come back in a second, which protect the primary residence of debtors from foreclosure, but require the liquidation of all other assets of the individual. So in many cases in Greece, people might own secondary properties, which can then be liquidated, and people are able to save their primary residence from being foreclosed or auctioned by banks. On the other hand, it also hints to the impact of short-term rentals, Airbnb, on the Greek housing market, as a lot of people own more than one properties, so they can rent out these throughout the year for short-term rentals and to make an extra income during the crisis. So generally speaking, the housing system in Greece was then tied to specific mechanisms of individual self-promotion for several decades. Mortgages only became relevant in the 1990s, when the Greek banking system was adjusted to the EU framework, and loans became a competitive service. This obviously led to the increase in mortgages and the increase in consumer credit and consumer credit demand, and general household borrowing increased at the time. So just to give you an example, in 2007, the outstanding amount of the total mortgage loans in Greece was 69 billion euros, amounting to more than 30% of the GDP. And obviously this expansion in mortgage credit was then followed by increases in rents, increases in real estate prices, and the consequent profitability of housing. Specifically, housing prices increased dramatically during the decades of the 1990s and 2000s, following similar trends in the rest of the European Union states. But household debt at the same time remained smaller, subprime lending was restricted, and securitization of mortgages was not prominent among Greek banks. So if looking at when looking at this figure, we can again see the high rate of property ownership in the Greek case. This peaked at 77% in 2010, and in 2007 was about 73%. So it decreased slightly during the crisis. But what we can also see is that ownership with a mortgage, with an outstanding mortgage, has been quite low during this decade and quite stable. So access to housing was significantly still provided by other means and not by mortgage credit, even in the decades of the 1990s and the 2000s. So we could say, we could generally argue, that the housing crisis in Greece was not caused by any pre-crisis lending practices. On the contrary, it was caused by the implementation of austerity measures following the sovereign debt crisis and increases in taxation by the Greek state, and especially property taxation. So this is a very basic figure again. I do not try to imply any type of causation between unemployment and non-performing loans. But as we can see, during the crisis, unemployment increased rapidly, peaking at 28% in 2013, and has since then declined a bit, while non-performing residential loans, or the ratio of non-performing residential loans, continues to increase as a ratio of all mortgage loans. This argument has been supported by several studies. In fact, Monokroussos and his colleagues published a working paper here at the Hellenic Observatory in which they substantiate that the sharp increase in non-performing loans in Greece can be mainly attributed to the unprecedented contraction of the domestic economic activity and the subsequent rise in unemployment. So we can find a causation between the rise in unemployment and non-performing mortgages in Greece. Specifically relating to housing, policy interventions as part of the economic adjustment programs of the Greek state targeted real estate property, which was increasingly taxed with the goal to increase public revenues. So the Greek state introduced a series of property taxes in the process of the crisis. The first was an emergency tax on all properties, which was to be collected through electricity bills. This amounted to about 1% of housing values and was imposed for purely fiscal purposes without any consideration of the impact on housing. And moreover, this tax was calculated on the fictitious pre-crisis levels of property values. Now this was a major problem in the Greek case, since as we already saw, home ownership and urban landed property are socially diffused. So the social consequences of taxing real property were quite complex at the time, as property had constituted a powerful protection against poverty and social exclusion. This tax was then replaced by a direct property tax in 2014, which is known as ENFIA from its initials. In English, it would be translated as the Unitary Real Estate Property Tax. And this tax was calculated by multiplying the square meters of a building by a principal tax and several other coefficients like the location of the building, the age of construction, and the floor of the property. So again, the outcomes of this law were quite problematic. So as I said, rather than resulting from the housing market, as was the case in the United States, for instance, the housing crisis in Greece has to be acknowledged as primarily an income and labor problem. It is mainly related to the inability of households, of people, to pay for their monthly housing expenses due to the increase of costs of basic utilities, and due to overtaxation, both of income and of property, following the economic adjustment programs. As a result, private debt of households towards banks, towards the state, and towards welfare organizations has risen significantly, as people cannot pay for their taxes, the contributions to Social Security, and for their outstanding mortgages. Thus, home ownership has increasingly been turned from a strategic asset and safety net for families into a burden for a large part of the population. And changes in the taxation system only led to the progressive transformation from a public to a private debt crisis in the Greek case, leading to evictions, foreclosures, and even the confiscation of money deposited in bank accounts, even for debt as little as 500 euros. But at the same time, at the beginning of the crisis, the Greek state introduced legislation that protected the primary residences of owner-occupied households from foreclosure, and it used two laws for this. One was Law 3718 of 2008, which banned auctions of properties of debtors for debts which did not exceed 100,000 pounds, euros. Well, it's almost the same nowadays, but yeah. And so this was until the end of 2011. And then this was even extended until 2013, but the debt was allowed to be up to 2,100 pounds. Debt to financial institutions was allowed to be up to 200,000 euros. And in 2014, this law was abolished. Nevertheless, the Greek state had already introduced a second law, a personal bankruptcy law, in 2010, which is also known as Katseli law because of the minister who legislated it. And this law concerned debtors which would be able to reach a settlement with banks, allowing them to exclude their primary residence from a credit institution's claims. This would only happen if they abided by the terms for servicing the debt agreed with the credit institutions. This law was seen as quite problematic by the financial institutions and by international investors. It was seen as being too debtor-friendly. It has been argued that it provides protection to strategic debtors who are able to pay for the debts but prefer to be covered behind this law. And therefore, it has been significantly amended in the upcoming years, first in 2015, and there are a new update is debated at the moment between the Greek banks and the Greek state, which significantly lowers the possibilities of a debtor to be included into the protection that this law provides. So there have been upper limits for the property value of a debtor, limits of how much debt, outstanding debt, the debtor still has to the bank, and even income criteria for the debtors have been applied. The people who legislate this law for instance, Luca Cazzelli, argued that one of the main incentives for this law was to protect the right to housing. In her words, compared to other states, the personal bankruptcy law was more progressive regarding the protection of the primary residence, which we saw as the social right to shelter. So there was this idea, and still there is this idea by Greek state actors, that the primary residence has to be protected, although there is increasing pressure by financial institutions and by the SSM to change its regulation. As I already mentioned, critics Solis Loas too debtor-friendly, and thus it pushed for the reforms. Nevertheless, up to 2017, the number of foreclosure auctions was quite low in the Greek case, significantly lower than the pre-crisis period. One of the reasons was, as I already mentioned, the laws that protected primary residences from foreclosure, but there was also significant citizen activism against foreclosure auctions, with citizen initiatives, activist groups, political organizations physically blocking the proceedings in courts. This comes from a court in Thessaloniki, and this banner reads, "No houses in the hands of the state or of bankers." So people were quite successful with these protests, and the number of foreclosure auctions was really low. So in 2017, only 1,092 auctions took place. It was only 632 in 2016, and this is compared to 4,469 that happened in 2009. But soon, the Greek state introduced electronic auctions to deal with such problems and the slow pace of the auction foreclosures, of the foreclosure auctions. And this has sped up the process. So in 20,000 e-auctions took place, about half of which were successful, and 85% of the properties in these auctions were purchased by the banks themselves. For 2019, there is a plan to hold 25,000 auctions, and this is supposed to be increased year after year. So it's about 30,000 in 2020 and 40,000 in 2021. So this is a snapshot of the platform that has been set up. So anybody can sign up, log in, and try to buy a property on this platform. As we can see at the moment, there are over 31,000 properties listed on the website, with 650 auctions taking place next week. So in addition to the increase in foreclosures, the Greek state during the same period has also introduced policies which are easing transactions between banks and international investors for dealing with non-performing loans and the associated collaterals. This regulations most importantly included the reform of the law regarding real estate investment companies, which is the Greek equivalent of real estate investment trusts, and the introduction of a law for the regulation of debt management companies, also called servicers, which manage the value of recovery from non-performing loans and the corresponding properties for banks or for private investors. So the purpose of real estate investment companies is the purchase, promotion, and rehabilitation of property for rent or for sale in the longer term. Real estate investment companies manage large income-yielding property portfolios. They have to be listed, and their stocks are usually owned by large funds. They were introduced in Greece in 1999, but significant reforms that widened their scope happened in 2013, which, among other things, enabled them to invest in housing, in residential real estate, up to 25% of their portfolios. As I already mentioned, real estate investment companies need to be listed within 2 years from their establishment, but this can, in some specific circumstances, be extended by another 2 years. But the most important advantage of REITs is their very favorable tax regime. First of all, they are exempt of property tax, property transfer tax on the acquisition of properties, which normally amounts to 3% of the sale price. Secondly, they are exempt from income tax, which is currently 26%, on profits generated from the sale of real estate assets, while their general income tax is very low. It's only 0.675% on the gross value of their assets. REITs are also exempt from the 10% tax on distributed dividends, while they have to distribute 50% of their dividends to shareholders annually, which is also exempt from the income tax. So the major REITs in Greece were founded by the country's systemic banks, four systemic banks, in the early 2000s, but have changed ownerships during the last decade. So the major REIT is MBG Panier, which is now largely owned by Invel Real Estate, and includes other major investment management companies such as Castle Lake or York Capital, which some of you might know because they've also invested in property in Spain, Ireland, and the US. The National Bank of Greece still holds a significant share of the stocks of the company. Then the second largest company is Grivalia Properties, which is majority owned by Fairfax, a Canadian investment management company. And recently there was a merger between Grivalia and Eurobank, so one of the four Greek systemic banks, with Fairfax now holding over 30% of Eurobank's shares. This merger also means that Grivalia will temporarily not be able to operate as a real estate investment company, but it is expected that another REIT will be created to which strategic properties in the bank's portfolio will be transferred. Trustor is then the third largest REIT in Greece. It's also majority owned by international investment management company, Varda Partners. And there are a series of smaller real estate investment companies, the most important of which is Orilina, where the major shareholder is the fund Brevan Howard, and which has not been listed yet. So the current value of real estate portfolios of these REITs is about 3 billion euros. But in 2018 alone, these REITs invested about 500 million in real estate, double the amount of what had been invested in 2017. So there has been a major increase in recent years in the investments in real estate by the REITs. So far, they have mainly invested in commercial property assets, in retail space, office complexes, and logistics. But especially in 2018, they tried to diversify their portfolios by increasingly also investing in hotels, in the hospitality sector, but also in student halls and other types of furnished accommodation. It should be added that the majority of the REIT's real estate properties are located in Athens. And the reason for these investments, especially in office complexes, for instance, is the very high yields that they can earn compared to other European states. So, sorry, this is not that visible, but Athens is here, so the yield on office space was in 2017 8%, when the European average was 5.4%. In addition to REITs, debt management companies were established in 2015. Several debt servicers, debt management companies, have been created since then. And at the moment, there are 14 such companies licensed by the Greek authorities. Loans that have not been serviced for more than 90 days may be assigned to these debt management companies, and the companies are entitled to take legal action to recover the debt. So banks can transfer non-performing loan portfolios to these management companies, and the same can be done also by private investors. And the creation of the servicers has also allowed banks to sell packages of non-performing loans, mainly non-performing business loans, to investors. And in 2018, several such transactions took place. In three occasions, they also included secured business loans, which were sold to major investment management companies, which are also active in other markets hit by the housing crisis, like the Spanish housing market. So in May 2018, Piraeus Bank sold a non-performing loan portfolio to Bain Capital. Then Attica Bank also sold a portfolio to Pacific Investment Management Company. And Alpha Bank sold a large portfolio to Apollo Investment in late 2018. In addition to these sales, banks have also attempted to sell residential assets or portfolios of residential assets in recent months, but this has mainly taken the form of selling individual units through their own online platforms. So banks have set up websites through which they sell individual properties. Eurobank went a step farther though and was in the process of selling a package of repossessed properties, but this deal was cancelled because of the merger with Revalia. So far, investments by REITs have mainly focused on professional properties, on commercial properties. And REITs have been quite skeptical about investing in housing, including rental housing, as they believe that the sector faces many barriers. Most importantly, the fragmentation of property ownership in Greece. For instance, when purchasing a portfolio of various good and bad housing assets bundled together by banks, an investor may end up owning one flat in a block of flats in which there are dozens of other properties, so they can't really do much with this one property in the block of flats. Additional problems mentioned by REITs are high management costs, and risks such as the vulnerability of renters to economic shocks, which are thus hindering these investments. Another quite popular argument among REITs is that they have been set up for investments in commercial property, and their teams have expertise in these fields and not in the housing market, for which there is no in-depth knowledge in the case of Greece, as rental homes have never been owned or managed at scale by the state or by corporations. The norm, instead, has been one or a few properties which are owned by non-professional landlords who are directly dependent on the income of these rentals. And a third argument, rather surprisingly or maybe not, has been made on ethical grounds by some of the REITs. So a senior executive of one of the major REITs told me that the REIT is not planning to invest in housing because there is a sensitivity by their principal investors and they don't want to be accused that they are taking people's homes away. Well, despite all of these reservations though, most of the REITs would agree that housing is an interesting sector which could provide which could produce significant income streams in the next years. For example, apartment prices, housing prices, have started to increase again in 2018 after a long period of decline. But they're still significantly lower to the pre-crisis levels, compared to the pre-crisis levels. Of course, there are some exceptions here, such as prime assets and those located in specific neighborhoods that have attracted the interest of other investors, such as those targeting the Golden Visa Scheme, which is a scheme for foreign investors and their families to invest at least 250,000 euros in property in order to get a five-year visa for Greece and the European Union, but also for short-term rentals. There have been significant increases there as well. I'm sorry that this graph is not in English. So here we can see the rental price increases between 2017 and 2018 in several Greek cities. So in the center of Athens, for instance, there has been an increase of about 20% in the rental prices between 2017 and 2018. Similar increases are witnessed in Thessaloniki. And the island of Crete has also been significantly affected. So Heraklion in Crete, Rethymno in Crete, and Chania in Crete. But the repossessed assets by banks are increasingly piling up in their spreadsheets. So far, banks have set up, as I mentioned, online platforms through which they sell individual properties, but they hold back on most properties as they expect price increases in the next years. In this context, the various stakeholders have followed divergent strategies and have divergent aspirations. Banks are trying to maintain their good portfolios, their good property assets, as they believe that due to the economic recovery, they will have higher yields. The supervisory authorities, on the contrary, are pressuring banks to sell their portfolios and let third parties manage non-performing loans in order to remove these from their balance sheets. And management companies have the motivation to purchase these packages and are thus pressuring supervisory authorities. The Greek housing market is thus currently in limbo. But banks will need to divest most of their real estate assets in the upcoming years under the Basel III regulatory reforms for the European banking sector and the regulations set by the SSM. So the single supervisory mechanism has set targets for the decrease of non-performing loans held by the Greek banks, which need to be reduced by 50 billion euros until the end of 2021. It is thus expected that the banks will start selling packages of properties and non-performing loans in the near future, which will then generate interest among REITs and transnational investors. So to conclude, I could say that so far, financialization and commodification or recommodification of housing has advanced at a much lower pace in Greece compared to other crisis states like Spain or like Ireland, the US. State regulation played a key role of both initially hindering the process through the introduction of legislation for the protection of property from foreclosure, but then increasingly enabled this process of financialization, facilitating the influx of global capital investments in the Greek housing market, while at the same time, the profitability of real estate has been elevated. So at the moment, it is still unclear how the different agents involved in the reshuffling of the housing market will proceed in the coming months and years, and there is no sign of policy interventions against what many perceive to be the large-scale dispossession of housing. But as I mentioned, we're still in a limbo, so we don't really know what's going to be happening in the next months. REITs seem to be hesitant in investing in real estate in housing markets, but this might change rapidly if transnational investors start start entering the market on a higher pace. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. A lot of material, I think, that we can pick up and discuss a bit more. Let me, as you collect your thoughts, kick off with a question. Philip, I never know whether to like the commodification of housing or not, because on the one hand it creates this kind of concentration of wealth, and then, you know, kind of bigger investors can come in and profit from, you know, as you were saying, you know, sort of by removing the use value and moving to a commercial exchange value. On the other hand, it is exactly the commodification of housing that creates this. In a way, it's democratizing, you know, it sort of distributes wealth to, I don't know, middle class or even lower, especially in places in the south where, as you said, there's very widespread home ownership across classes. So I guess the equivalent here would be the right to buy scheme, which was initiated by the Thatcher governments, where tenants of social housing were, in a way, one way or another, you know, handed out a couple of hundred thousand or whatever by the ability to buy very low and then sell within beyond 2 years at commercial prices. So what's the question? So the question is, should we then, I mean, you know, you're looking at a period of crisis, so it's more about foreclosures and auctions, but at some point there will be, you know, an upswing in the economy, and then we'll be looking at, am I right then to assume that then we would be looking at a distribution of wealth, kind of more democratization of wealth in the sense that more people will have access to, you know, they would be able to sell the property and they won't rely on grandparent handouts, but there would be a market for them to go and compete.
So on commodification or financialization of housing, as you mentioned, the process of commodification in Greece in the post Second World War decades can be seen as a process of democratization of housing. So there was large scale, socially widespread access to home ownership through the low cost of housing and through the different strategies available to agents to get access to home ownership. Nevertheless, the current round of commodification is rather the opposite. I don't see it as leading to a democratization of housing. On the contrary, it leads to the concentration of housing to specific actors, which are transnational investors, real estate investment companies, specific funds, specific investors. So this is rather leading to a transformation of housing from a large rate of home ownership to one which might be characterized by a large rate of property rentals. So it's a deep democratization of housing currently occurring in the Greek context. Well, not yet, actually. I mean, it's still, as I said, in limbo. We don't really know what's going to happen. It hasn't advanced as much as it has in Spain or in the US, where these new rental markets have been created, and they have secured rental streams for real estate investment companies. But yeah, the tendency is the democratization of housing in this context.
Okay, thanks. Talk about this more in the office. opening up for questions. Yes, a question first here.
Foreclosures, are they linked to people who took
mortgages, I wasn't arguing that there were no mortgages. I mean, the mortgages played an important role, but there were no risky practices by banks. So in a large amount of the mortgages were repaid within, let's say, a few decades. So there was a significant market of mortgages. So in the 1990s, access to housing was tied to mortgage loans, less than in the previous decades. Nevertheless, the housing crisis was not caused by the lending practices of banks, like was the case in the US, but on the contrary, as I argued, was a result of austerity measures, and of taxation. People who were still holding mortgages or other types of loans were increasingly not able to repay these loans. So this is one of the categories of people who had to deal with foreclosure of the properties. The other is people who have debt towards the state, as the state is also foreclosing and auctioning properties. And this is even, I didn't mention this before, but this is very significant because there's no legal protection like the personal bankruptcy law for debt towards the state. So there have been a significant number of foreclosures by the state or by state actors. And if I remember correctly, in 2016, the Greek state foreclosed and got access to about 10,000 properties. So significantly higher than the foreclosed properties that we saw from banks.
Turn this into a question.
It's because of the small business, the small size of business. Most people, when they were taking out commercial loans, they had their houses as collateral. That was the main reason. It was because they're owing loans to banks, you know, for their personal mortgages. So this is the reason they and practically their own.
Thank you very much for your comments.
I thought you also had a question.
Well, I think
do you want to respond to some of
No, I completely agree with your comments. And And I was trying to make the point, probably it didn't become that clear, that foreclosures were the result of increasing indebtedness towards the state as well. So the decrease in disposable income was the main reason for increased indebtedness. Well, thank you for both questions. The first point that you raise is very important, and it has been one of the reasons why banks, why financial institutions have been so hesitant with, or one of the reasons why banks have been so hesitant with releasing properties and non-performing loans to the market. So the fear that property prices will significantly decrease because of this mass availability of housing to the market. So this is one of the problems with which they are dealing, but increased problems that they're facing with their liquidity because of the large portfolios of non-performing loans that they still have on their sheets will force them to sell large parts of their portfolios in the next years. So we will see a decline in property prices, which will definitely help transnational investors when purchasing these large portfolios for a much cheaper price than they would have to pay now, for instance. Although at the moment we have seen an increase in property prices. Regarding the tax regime of real estate investment companies, as I said, these were founded, the first law was passed in 1999, but significant changes occurred in 2013 with the law that allowed real estate investment companies to also invest in residential and hotel assets. But apart from that, the regime is largely the same. There has been one significant change, which happened in 2016, which was that the current government increased this annual tax from 0.1% to 0.675%. But apart from that, it stands for the same, the law, since 1999.
And are they exempted only from real estate transfer tax or also from recurring property taxation? As far as I understand, the recurring property tax is also quite important in this. So the annual property tax that all households pay.
Oh, they have to pay.
So they're not exempted.
No, they're not exempt, but they have to pay a low rate.
On this, can I? I'll take a question. Can I, since we're on the slide, do you know what is the logic of the last point? Why should there be a 50% of dividends have to be to shareholders, and why there shouldn't be an income tax for the dividends? Yeah, yeah, I'm not talking about the penultimate point. I'm talking about the last point, though.
Yeah, the last point is because they have increased the taxation from 1% to 2.6%, so they have to reduce the tax on dividends, what is paid out, to compensate.
Yeah.
My economics don't help me. Make a comment. It seems unusual. I don't know about the experience of other countries, but it seems unusual to have a threshold of how much to distribute and then not to tax the distributed profits. It seems like a handout to me.
Yeah, but the penultimate paragraph was to satisfy the series of
that I understand.
The other one is
okay.
But most of the REITs distribute more than 50% of their dividends to shareholders.
Because there's no tax on that. Yeah. Okay, let's take the other question.
With the banks burdened by so many non-performing mortgages, is there another option other than to foreclose and liquidate?
It seems that there is no alternative, at least on the part of the banking sector. But as I mentioned, the state is also foreclosing properties. So the state could think about alternatives in this sense. They could think about creating a social housing market, for instance, with all of these properties that end up in their portfolio. So there are definitely some alternatives which would reduce the impact of losing.
State foreclosures.
Yeah, but the state has to take the loan.
Yes.
It's a different thing. The state does it because they need money.
They do. They can securitize the stream of income and get. Anyway, yeah. Okay. So I did have a question about social housing. Is there a discussion about social housing in Greece?
Not that I know about. The current government has introduced a rental housing benefit, which is quite low though, but it obviously this can't substitute a social rental housing market.
Is it low compared
well,
to
it is
because you showed that the rents went down by kind of 50% over the crisis, right?
Yeah, but now they have been increasing again in recent years because of Airbnb as well, and for a single person a benefit of £70 when they have to pay a rent of €350 is not really that much.
I have another question, and if there's more questions please indicate in the audience, but there's obviously the property tax, the MFR, has been criticized a lot, and like invariably everybody was complaining about it from left and right. And you seem to have, so when you were talking about it to have a kind of a negative disposition to it, but in a way, if land is owned, sort of properties are owned quite democratically across the population, and if much of it was created by, as you were saying, a model where there was no mass taxation on creating property, it doesn't make sense then to have a property tax. So if you allow adiparohi or, you know, so the lack of planning and stuff, so everybody ends up with a couple of apartments or whatever, and if everybody, you know, so as you said, across income groups, there's, you know, very high rates of homeownership, then doesn't it make sense to have a high property tax? It's well, high.
The critique was not so much of the property tax as such, but of the way that it has been charged, that people have been taxed by this property tax. So as you mentioned, there is socially diffused property ownership. Most of the neighborhoods are also social classes cohabitate in the same neighborhoods in many occasions, but you might end up being poor, but in a neighborhood with a very high coefficient. So this is kind of the problematic part there. That there is an unequal burden put on the poorer part of the population, as income is not part of the property tax. It would make sense to include other coefficients to the property tax.
Vasily, following up what you said about Penfia, in my experience, the people who actually kind of, you know, aspired to and kind of planned the Penfia measure, it was more of a way to actually make up for the inefficiency of the Greek state to actually collect the taxes that it was supposed to collect and to reach the revenue targets. So one easy way to actually reach the revenue targets at the time kind of impose some kind of horizontal tax on this kind of property, which is easy to collect, right? Because you actually can collect via the electricity bills at the time. So it was more like a way of making up for the inefficiency of the wide inefficiency of the Greek state rather than, you know, maybe some kind of base that you measure.
Yes.
Yeah, that's common, yeah. Do you agree? Yes.
Now, you have presented rate of returns in areas where there is a large concentration of students.
Yes.
I don't know if you're familiar with the UK market, but the most thriving sector, the construction sector in the UK, is the building and management of properties for students.
In fact, they have started investing in the sector as well, and so in student halls. Especially Ethniki Pangaea has made several investments in 2018, both in Athens and in Thessaloniki, but also in smaller cities like in Patra. And other REITs are also looking into this market. So it's one of the potential growth markets for these kind of companies. They're also looking at other sectors, like, for instance, accommodation for the elderly, which they believe will also increase in the next decades in Greece, will become more relevant.
Okay.
the last question and then we can move on. You said we're in a kind of policy limbo and we don't know where it's not policy limbo, but you know, we don't know where kind of the market is going to go. What do you think are the main threats or the main kind of sort of considerations, you know, the main factors that may influence where the market goes? So is the kind of, you know, the fiscal position of the country at large, which alludes also to the title of your paper, or is there some specific regulations in the housing market or in taxation that would kind of make the difference in what is the at stake?
Certainly all of these will play a role. What Sasha mentioned, for instance, is that there is the fear about the contraction of the market and about the decrease in property prices if so many thousands of properties are released into the market. So this is one of the major concerns. At the same time, banks need to get rid of the non-performing loans and of properties on their portfolios as part of the Basel III criteria. So in my eyes, it looks like we're going into a specific direction. So we're going into a more concentrated housing market. We're moving to an increase of rental properties in Greece, and people living in rental housing.
Cheaper housing because prices will have gone down. Maybe not.
Depending on the area. So if we look at Airbnb, for instance, this is part of another project that I'm working on. So this is a map of the city center of the city of Thessaloniki. So we see that in the city center of Thessaloniki, Airbnb has created problems. So short-term rentals have taken over a significant amount of vacant housing stock in the city, putting pressure to the rest of the housing market and thus increasing rents in these parts of the cities. The effects are not there in other neighborhoods and other boroughs. So there, we people might benefit from cheaper rents.
Incidentally, on Airbnb, I was reading something on Kathimerini yesterday, and then I switched on the telly, and there was a feature on BBC about Airbnb. So it's all happening about Airbnb. Okay, we'll have to stop here. Let me make two announcements before we thank again Philip for his presentation and the discussion. So our next